committee will come to order. I want to announce that Representative Gelser and Representative Reed are excused from today's committee meeting because they are attending a... Except Gelser's here. Representative Reed, at least, is attending a prison tour as part of his responsibility on the House Judiciary Committee. I thought you were going to be gone, too.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to prison today.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad you're here. And we missed it yesterday, so Representative Witt, take a minute or two and introduce yourself, if you would, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Brad Witt. I'm the representative from House District 31, which is essentially the northwest corner of the state. My district runs from Sobey Island, just north of Portland, on out to Astoria. And the southernmost community in my district is Vernonia. We run along the Columbia River, along Highway 30, and traditionally, it has been a natural resource based economy in that area, fairly much rural, and we've been blessed here in the last couple of years. My district, actually, I think before we're done, will become energy central of the Northwest, and we have about $8 billion of actual and or prospective economic development in my district, much of it focused on energy, but a very significant rebirth in the tourism and related industries in Astoria. Favorite pastimes include hunting and fishing, which a lot of people engage in my district, and of course it's just a natural there. Also enjoy restoring classic American double barrel side lock shotguns. Those are a piece by piece task, and it's probably going to be a lifetime endeavor. And also enjoy building custom made rifles from time to time. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to introduce myself.
Thank you, Representative Witt. And I have a question.
Yes, sir.
If I may, do you ever fire any of those guns
it's one of these things, Mr. Chairman, you always got to get that next piece put together on it. It's just finding the time. But yes, I really enjoy that when I get the opportunity.
You're a man who understands gun control.
That's true. Thank you. That's very, very interesting and helpful. Today we're going to talk about our work plan again. We went over it yesterday and with review, and I wanted to let you know that there's already been some discussion about having some joint meetings with the Environment Committee. I got the name right? I think so. The committee chaired by Representative Dingfelder to talk about biofuels issues and to hold public hearings so that we don't have to have two sets of public hearings, that in fact we can do it in one. And we're discussing the possibility of doing that the week after next. I mention that now because our tentative schedule calls for the week after next to be involved in some other things. It just so happens that committee meets at the same time we do on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So with that potential wrinkle, I'd entertain conversation about the plan. Yes, Representative.
In conjunction with that, and I know this is a pain in the neck for staff, but if it would work, this is a major issue, this biofuels, if it would work to have a field trip hearing where we go to the public a little bit somewhere, within driving distance, I would really enjoy that.
Burial.
Well, I was thinking of, some place where they do biofuel and we could,
Great new plant, biofuel plant right in Ontario.
There's one in Salem I was thinking of.
That's the driving distance.
A little closer.
Yeah, well, and I guess also...
Ontario.
You like Ontario. Ontario's fine. But I don't know if you've... We did some field trips last time, and I found like a tour of the lottery to be very helpful when we talked about lottery, and I found a tour of the revenue... And I'm not saying we have to do the whole thing again, Paul, but I, if the chair would consider where feasible and manageable, it's helpful to get a visual rather than just sitting in this room all the time.
Great suggestion. I assume that's something we can look into.
Yes, Mr. Chair, as Representative Berger pointed out, we did a series of them last session. The department's always certainly willing to set up a review of their processing system, which I think a lot of people have found interesting. They start getting heated up here in the next couple months on processing tax returns. The other thing we did, as I recall, was a little tobacco distributor up in Port, or tobacco warehouser,
mm-hmm.
which was kind of interesting. OLCC.
So the liquor warehouse.
Okay. So we can certainly set those things up if that's the desire of the committee.
Which of those gave us the free samples last time? I keep forgetting.
It's my memory, Representative Butler, that you didn't take any samples of the liquor.
I think your memory's pretty good.
That's probably accurate. Well, thank you. The request is that we consider some field hearings or some tours so we can see how some facilities are actually operating.
If it would be helpful to our policy debate here.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of things I don't know anything about.
I think it's a wonderful suggestion. I think our issue is going to be to figure out how we can get through our agenda, because we have a massive agenda for this year. And of course, as you know, the schedule that we propose to follow gets us out of the building by the end of June, and with out of this committee, we hope long before that. So we'll look at that, and I'll ask Paul to see what we can do about that kind of a schedule. Other comments about the proposed committee work plan or thoughts? Okay. And I'm looking to see whether we are going to adopt that work plan. We are. So is there any objection to the adoption of the work plan as printed?
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the work plan as prepared and presented.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves that we adopt the work plan as presented. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Paul, why don't you go ahead and introduce our information meeting for today?
Okay. Mr. Chair, by way of setting up your topic today, we did get a couple of bills related to the school distribution formula today in possession of the committee. One on what's called the teacher experience factor, to look at that as an adjustment, and it's currently in the formula. The other is how we account for declining enrollment in districts. So to address those questions and a whole lot more is Steve Meyer. Steve is our economist that works on the school finance. The model that he uses can take any level of state school funding, local resource plus state school fund, and show how that affects the individual districts. And of course, he can show you how any proposed changes would affect individual districts. So Steve Meyer is our school finance person.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. What I want to do this afternoon is to walk you through the distribution formula, list the resources that are included in the formula, and then how the formula actually works to allocate those resources among the various school districts. And as we go through that, you can think about how that affects your school districts and how fair it is to your school districts versus other kinds of school districts in the state. We won't really talk about that, but that's something to think about as we work through it. I like to show this slide just to give you a rough idea of the magnitude involved in the education process, the number of students, teachers, support staff, whether it's administrative staff, clerical staff, bus drivers, librarians, whoever. And a rough idea of the number of school sites, and there are now 197 school districts, not 198. Brothers merged with sisters recently.
The legal?
We had a bill on that one.
Measure 36 for him.
So we'll be talking about two levels of equity or fairness. First, between all school districts and education service districts, and then break that down between all school districts and then also between all ESDs. So that's basically what we want to try and get through this afternoon. There's more slides here than what we'll get through. When time runs out, we'll stop. And feel free to ask questions as we go, even if it's necessary to keep you awake. This is scheduled on Friday afternoon so that you have the weekend to recover. So bear with me. All right, first, overall, we want to start with the state school fund and talk about how it's lit up. A certain amount of dollars come off of the, off, referred to as off the top, for special uses. It's set aside before any further allocation of the state school fund. Then the remaining state school fund is in, added to the school and ESD local revenue, primarily property taxes, but we'll talk about some other sources that it's included in local revenue also. So with the local revenue and the remaining state school fund, that's the total pool of funds that we have available to talk about the allocation. Right, how's it split up between schools and ESDs? This changed last session. Currently, school districts get 95.25% of that big pot. ESDs get 4.75% of it. Before the change last session, it was 95 school districts, 5% ESDs.
A question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, in that process, my recollection was that the small ESDs, even though the percentages went down to from 5 down to 4.75, the small ESDs, in order to keep them serving, and typically those small ESDs are in large rural areas serving, you know, huge number of square miles with lots of windshield time, that they were all guaranteed a minimum of $1 million. And I think we passed a piece of legislation last time that said, well, you know, $950,000 would be the guarantee. And I don't think any of them, of the really small ones, really received $950,000. Is that your recollection?
Oh, in case we don't get that far into ESDs, I'll answer it now. It was $1 million. When the legislature adopted the 4.75%, the million declined to $950,000. Because that's above what the percentage that the other ESDs get
per student,
we have to take a small reduction for all of the ESDs to keep it within their 4.75%. Right. So they'll get 99 point some percent of that $950,000, and that will become clear once in the ESD
thank
section.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Of that total, state school fund makes up about 67% of that big pot. Property taxes 30%, and other local revenue about 3%. The state school fund portion has dropped a little bit over time. A few years ago, in the early 90s, after the adoption of the school formula, it was about 70%. So with the recession and other things that have taken place, that share has declined somewhat. Okay, now to get into the formula detail, we'll first mention what the formula is not about, just to help focus what we're talking about. It's not about a general cost reimbursement, although there is some aspect of that in the formula. There's no revenue entitlement per student, so we're not talking about paying $5,000 or $6,000 per student. There's no adequacy or stability references in the formula. Nothing about student outcomes or test levels, achievement levels. Nothing about what the quantity of input should be, how many students per teacher. Nothing about what the quality of the program should be, or who's accountable, or how they're accountable. Those are all topics that weren't even on the radar screen in 1991 when this formula was first put together. And so the formula doesn't really address them. What is it about? It's basically about defining the fairness of school funding, and it does that by measuring a relative need of each school district relative to all of the other school districts. So it's not an absolute amount, it's a relative amount. And so we're not concerned with how much is in the state school fund. We're concerned about, given some level of state school fund, what's fair and how that's shared. It also reflects the finance issues and court decisions of the 80s. The primary question then dealt with equalizing property wealth per district, not dollars per student necessarily, but property wealth. And then refining equity, whenever you change the formula or make adjustments, you are in effect redefining what the equity for that formula is. In 1991, a work group put together the basic formula that we still have with some changes. They had four principles that they tried to follow in doing that. One was to share state school funding sources statewide. So that's why the formula includes the local revenue as well as the state school fund dollars. It decided to let each district basically decide how to spend its allocation, so local control being maintained. And that basically meant giving state aid in a lump sum, not in various grants or for various costs. And then also to make differentiations between districts based upon uncontrollable cost differences. And we'll find that in the formula. A district can't control how much its transportation costs are. It depends upon how many students they have, how dispersed they are, over what territory. So that's a factor in the formula. And then also to avoid incentives to increase district allocation. Basically, try to make it simple enough so that districts can't game the formula. Can't try to make decisions to take advantage of the formula and increase their share of the revenue. And basically doing that by setting various limits and classifications. And we'll run across this as we go through. Okay, very simply, the equalization formula can be stated as state revenue plus local revenue equals the sum of four grants: a general purpose grant, transportation grant, high cost disability grant, and the facility grant. That's in its simplest form. If you understand how those interact and how the grants are calculated, then you understand that very well. And we'll come back to this in a different form. Looking at the revenue portion or side of the equation, the state school fund in 05-07 was mostly from the general fund, but there has been a little bit from the lottery revenue the last few biennia, and that totaled about $5.3 billion last biennia, current biennium in terms of 05-07. Just a reminder that it's not all general fund. Okay, how's that state school fund divided up? The uses off the top that I mentioned are for small high schools, $5 million, state special education, $16.5 million. Is an estimate. There's no set limit on the state special education dollars. And then to implement the virtual school program, $2 million was taken out of the state school fund last session. So after those come off the top, then you have your division between the K-12 and ESD.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelson.
What is that state special education fund? Is that the school for the blind, the school for the deaf?
Yes, it includes those, and it also includes two others. It's in a later slide, and I can't think of it now. Hospitalizations, students that are in the hospitals, and also in long-term care, provide some education while they're in those institutions.
Thank you.
What's the sources of local revenue? It's not just property taxes, but the property tax portion is property taxes collected, so it could be property taxes that are paid this year but are owed for prior years. And then also all of the current year taxes aren't collected, some don't pay. So you have the prior year and the unpaid current year hopefully pretty much offsetting one another. But it's the taxes collected, not levied. And the Common School Fund, County School Fund, Federal Force Revenue. Let me mention here that in the estimates that are being used currently, the Federal Force Revenue is being included as zero. We're not assuming that there will be any revenue for this source. So if Congress decides to allocate some money for Federal Force Revenue, it will be in addition to the numbers that you'll be seeing.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, let me go back to the first. The operating property tax is collected. If I live in a district which has, which is going to collect $1 million in revenue locally through my property tax, and I have a community college portion in that, is that divided out right there locally?
It's divided up locally, yes. But this would only be the portion going to those K-12 school districts.
So they would actually peel that off, the community colleges would peel that off at that point then?
They have a separate levy, and they get their own share of the total collected, just as any other property taxing district would.
Okay. And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
With regard to the Common School Fund, the Common School Fund is really a state-administered program, is it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, it is.
And so why do we call that a local formula revenue? How is that? I'm having trouble with it being a local formula.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it's referred to as local primarily because all of these existed prior to the new formula.
Okay.
And they were considered, the school districts were local. All of this revenue was considered local. It's pretty much generated local.
Okay.
But it's not necessarily distributed that way.
And a final question, Mr.
Chair. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The county school fund, that's the $10 that counties, do they still do that? Do they still put that money in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no. There's no longer a requirement that it be $10 per student.
Does any county actually put the $10 in for per student now?
I'm not sure. If any do, I doubt it.
Okay. Sounds like the last of the buggy whip manufacturing days there.
But there are still some sources of revenue that are dedicated to the county school fund.
Oh, okay.
They're fairly minor, but they do exist.
But counties typically don't generate out of general fund any money for county or for the county school fund.
No. Once the $10 requirement went away, counties pretty much stopped.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, then you have also the state-managed county trust force, so that this is from the Tillamook and Clatsop state forest lands that go to the schools. That some of that revenue is shared with the school districts in those counties. The ESD excess local revenue can be a confusing one. When we went through the equalization of ESD revenue, it was obvious that some ESDs had a lot more local revenue than what the formula was going to allocate to them. The question was, should they be able to keep it, or should it have to go somewhere else? And the decision was that rather than the ESDs keeping it and making the dollar amounts per student in the ESD less equal, that the ESD should share that with their component school districts. And so that's what they have to do now in the following year. And then there's a minor amount of revenue in lieu of property taxes that come into play too, but it's a very minor amount. Local revenue gives you the various shares here, property taxes being about 91%, federal force, if it exists, under 3%, common school fund, not quite 4%, and all other a little over 2%, out of about $2.5 billion in 2005-07. All right. Back to the equalization formula now. We've talked about the upper box, the one side of the equation. Now we want to get down into a little bit more detail on each of the grants. The cost factors that are included in the formula to differentiate the uncontrollable costs are the weights, student weights that are used, and we'll talk about those in more detail, the teacher experience adjustment factor, transportation costs, high-cost disability students, and new facility costs. Those are the cost drivers in the formula. Are they the most important? that's debatable. But they were considered important at the beginning. And the two new ones are the high-cost disability and new facility. All right, we'll start with the facility grant since it's probably the most straightforward of the four grants. It's up to 8% of construction costs, and I say up to 8% because there is a $25 million cap for the biennium on what those facility grants can be. And if they exceed the $25 million, then they're prorated down. So we have not yet had a biennium when it was 8%. The cap has always come into play, and it's been below 8%. The last date I have, it was like 3 or 4%. But that was with a $17.5 million biennial cap. So hopefully it will go up above that with the $25 million. The money cannot be used for construction, and it's paid in the school year that the facility is opened up and used.
If I'm sure. See, was that occasioned as a result of Measure 5? Is that when that came into being that we couldn't use was that 4750 that came into being?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, Measure 47.
47.
Said bonds couldn't be used for anything, for furnishings and equipment.
Right.
Couldn't be used for anything that wasn't intrinsic to the structure itself, or attached to the structure.
Okay,
and so the legislature passed this to help fund those furnishings and equipment that the district had to put into the building. Desks, chairs, computers.
And if I may follow up, if a school district is short and the funds, the 8% cap, with the $25 million funding that we peel off the top of education for the facility grant money, if that's short, what do they do if they need another $500,000 to be able to put the ports in for computers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that has to then come from another source, whether it's another part of the revenue from the formula or whether it's from non-formula revenue.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand this correctly, a school district goes out, they pass a bond in order to build a new facility, and the first year it's open, do they apply competitively for these dollars, or are they automatically granted from the state up to 8%, their prorated portion of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, they apply, but it's not competitive.
Yeah.
They apply, the department adds it all up, says what percent can it be and still stay within the $25 million cap on a biennial basis. So the more that apply, the more the construction that first used that school year, the smaller that percent is going to be that they get of their construction costs.
Okay. And follow up?
Yes.
In terms of the allowable uses of those dollars that are brought in from the bond, what's intrinsic to the building? Would that be the built-in bookshelves, the computer ports, but not the computers themselves?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I imagine so. I'm not.
Okay.
I can't make a clear distinction between the two. That takes someone else that's familiar with the construction.
Yeah, we had some
process.
We had some conversation about that when the measure came in when I was on the Eugene School Board, and I recall that the definitions were a little bit unusual. So I wouldn't rely on our supposition that just because it's built in, it must be covered. I think we need to know specifically before we be sure. Yeah.
I'm sure the department has some directions on that.
Thank you.
It can be, the construction can be for new construction, additions, or portables, and it does not include land costs. Any questions on facilities before going on to high-cost disability? All right. Again, this is another grant that has a cap so that the language I use is to say it equals up to the sum of eligible costs above $30,000 per disability student. Okay. So for each disability student, the district can add up the costs that are above $30,000, not below, and then submit those for a high-cost disability grant. This grant also has a cap of $12 million per year, not per biennium like the facility grant. This is on an annual basis. And then the costs are prorated if the total is above $12 million. This was first passed in 2003 on a temporary basis, starting out with costs above $25,000. The estimates during the session were too low. The $25,000, the $12 million for costs above $25,000 didn't go as far as we thought they would. And so the issue last session is, well, how do we deal with this? Do we increase the $12 million or do we increase the amount, the threshold above $25,000? And the decision was to increase the threshold to $30,000 per student. So hopefully this time around, the percentage of those costs that the grant covers will be higher than 70%. But I think you'll also see during this time span that there'll be more districts that apply. And so the cost, the eligible cost, will go up even with the 30,000 threshold. So I think the percent of those costs that will be covered will increase, but not as much as we expected during last session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelfand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any states that have school funding formulas that look at the cost of special education by rather than just doing a twice weight for each kid and then picking up the really high cost kids when they get to four or five times that regular cost, weight out the types of disabilities or the types of needs so that the formula is more accurately delivering funds to districts based on the types of students that they have so that they aren't in the hole when they do have a very high need kid with high cost needs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, yes, there are states that do it that way. Some states will have different weights for different disabilities. Some states will have funding based upon the placement of the student, whether he's full-time in the classroom, part-time, whether he's in a separate classroom, whatever that placement happens to be. The number of states that use a weight, I think, is less than the number of states that use some other method. And Oregon, if I recall correctly, is the only state that uses one weight for all disabilities, all classes of disabilities.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Does that mean that a student that had a speech impediment that received speech services as part of a group maybe once a month would receive the same weight as a student that had profound disabilities and needed nursing care during the school day?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, yes, as long as we're only talking about weight revenue and not any of the high-cost
okay.
disability dollars.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, the transportation grant. This is one of the original two. It equals 70% or up to 90% of approved transportation costs.
That's right.
Originally, it was just 70% across the board. But a couple sessions ago, they added districts at 80% and 90% so that basically districts are ranked in terms of cost per student. The higher ones get 90% of their approved transportation costs. The top 10% get 90%, the next 10% of the districts get 80%, and then the bottom 70% of the districts, 80% of the districts get 70%. So that was to help districts that had unusually high transportation costs. There's my table to get the percentages right in terms of the ranking and the percent of the costs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, with regard to transportation, is that left up to the district to go ahead and develop its own transportation policy? And the reason I ask is that in some of my more rural areas, they'll pick folks up on this street a mile away and further, but across the street, the people that live on that side have to make their own arrangements. And then when we get into Portland area, you know, it might be three blocks as opposed to a mile away. So is that a district-by-district decision in order to come up with these transportation costs that we reimburse?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, there are no requirements that the district has to use the most efficient means of transporting the students. It's just a matter of the requirement that if the student is more than an elementary student is more than a mile away, they have to provide bus service. But the high school student, if it's more than a mile and a half away from the school, they have to provide transportation. You can argue that the 70% reimbursement is used to help encourage efficiency because the other 30% has to come somewhere else. Okay. Well, let's just deal with that. If 70% of the costs are included in the transportation grant, where does the district get the other 30%? It's from some other grant dollars, pretty much. It's going to come from the general purpose grant, in effect.
And so, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, yeah.
I'm just concerned that if it is the mile and the mile and a half, that's uniform, but if a school, again, in a much more metropolitan area, wants to pick up students three blocks from the school, they can do that, but they have to do it if they live a mile or more away if they're in K-8, and then for high school, it's a mile and a half that they must, mile and a half and further.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know of anything, any rule the department has that says you can't pick up students if they live within those mileage requirements. If they're within that mile, you know, that they don't have to pick them up.
Do we have any knowledge of any districts that actually do that?
I don't know the transportation systems out there well enough to answer that, Mr. Chair.
I mean, my sense of things is that this 70% restriction really works pretty well to encourage efficiencies, because the rest of the money has to come out of the general fund, out of the school district's general operating fund. And in Eugene, at least, several years ago, they started transporting high school students by Lane Transit District bus, because it was cheaper than running our own buses, and we only run buses for high school students who live more than a mile and a half from the LTD bus stop. We do buy bus passes for students who are in free or reduced lunch and therefore can't afford to buy their own.
No, we're not talking about some disabled students here that have
correct.
To provide
disabled students are
accepted. From their house.
But the point of my statement, of course, is that in Eugene, they figured it was worth the savings to actually go to this other system, and they went to it because it reduced costs. Representative, is it Wett? I'm sorry. Somebody over here asked. I'm sorry. I missed it. Okay. Go ahead.
This just gives you an idea of how the transportation costs have grown over time. And it splits it up between the 30% non-formula or non-grant portion of the formula dollars and the 70% that's included in the formula. So it's grown over time as the number of students have grown, as the costs for buses, et cetera, have grown as well. And it might be also related to students living further away from the schools in suburbs and being a little bit more spread out. All right, the last grant, the general purpose grant, is the most complicated of the four.
Okay.
It will take a little bit more time. It's weighted students, and we'll talk about those weights as a little bit more detail. Times $4,500, with that $4,500 adjusted by a teacher experience factor, and Paul mentioned that that's in one of the bills you'll have in the committee. And then there's a balancing to the available funds. And we'll talk about each of those in a little bit more detail. Student counts, we talk about ADM, average daily membership, with kindergarten at a half weight. And then we have weighted ADM, is just the additional weights that we'll be talking about added to ADM. And then we have the concept of extended ADMW, or weighted ADM. And that's either the higher of the current year ADMW or the prior year ADMW. So if it's a school district with declining students, they're going to use last year's ADMW for their in the formula for their count.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do all schools calculate the ADMW the same way? If I have a student who, if I have 10 students, each of whom miss one day a week, that's 80% attendance. There's still 10 ADMW there, I mean, or 10 students ADM. If they miss, there's something about that formula for counting the ADM that I became aware of this past year that I just really didn't understand. But students can miss various days, I think we finally came to the conclusion that students could miss up to 50% of the day and they'd still be a student. Are all schools, the 197 districts, are they calculating that the same way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, they should be. Right? The department has rules about how to do that. They have to attend at least a half a day to count that day as a full day attendance. And then also it includes, first I thought you were getting to, well, what happens when a student drops out? So this basically is an average over the school year for enrollment every day of their school year. So as students drop out, enrollment goes down for that day following the rest of the school year. And that's then averaged out over the whole school year.
So if I could follow up. So if I have 1,000 students in the school district and all of them show up every day, but they only show up for a half of a day, then I've got 1,000 ADM.
Yes.
Okay. And if I have students that show up only... So if all of the 1,000 students only showed up for 2.5 days a week or 5 days out of every 10 school days, would I still have a 10,000 or 1,000 students?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, someone that knows a little bit more about the regulations, I think, should answer your question.
Okay. That's fine, Steve. There's something quirky about that, and one of the things that we came to, Mr. Chair, and that concerned me a little bit was there was a day in the spring and a day in the fall that everybody needed to be in school in order to be counted, and the question that my constituent came forward with was, if that student is only half time all the rest of the time, and they're there in the spring and they're there in the fall on that particular day, are you getting one ADM as a result of that student? And I think the response from my schools was, that student's a full ADM.
Yes.
Even though they're really not there most of the time.
Mm-hmm. That would be my initial answer as well.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure that that's right, but I'll accept it. I'm not sure that it's correct. Well, you know what I mean.
But I think what you're saying is that there is a regulation that tells the school district how to account for that, yes. And that they are... Their payment from the school fund is dependent upon that number.
Correct, and that's just like, well, it's similar, maybe similar to, there's not a minimum number of school days, but there's a minimum number of school hours per year.
So. Right. Well, that of course counts for the districts that only meet 4 days a week but have a longer school day.
Correct. All right, moving on to the weights. These are the weights that are included in the formula. The individual education program, basically disability students, has one extra weight for a total of two. Students in poverty get a one-fourth extra weight. Students in English as a second language program get an extra half weight. Pregnant and parenting, extra one weight. Neglected and delinquent and student in foster homes each a quarter extra weight.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. So kindergartners that are in a district that have a full-day kindergarten, does the state reimburse them at a full weight or a half weight?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, a half weight.
And a follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
So if it's a kindergarten student that's in special education, is the school district getting reimbursed at one weight or 1.5? So do they get a full extra weight for special education, or do they just get twice with the base?
Mr. Chair, President Kelser, I haven't had that asked me before. I think it would be twice the half weight for a one. But I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
I'll have to check on that.
Thank you.
I think that's correct, Steve. I went through that formula once and looked at that. I think they get the half weight times that student. But the ESL, doesn't NCLB put a limit to the 5 years on the ESL, or is there no limit? How many years can a student be claimed for the 1.5 waiting for ESL?
Mr. Chair, President Butler, there's no limit that I'm aware of.
So they could be there for 12 years and never learn.
The department has a stipulation as to when does that student become proficient in English. And if they can't meet that stipulation, then presumably they could do it for the whole time that they're in the school.
We'll follow up. But doesn't NCLB put a limit of 5 years on ESL? I thought they did.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think I have seen that.
Okay.
But I'm talking about state law.
Right. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelson.
Can I actually do my follow-up to my previous question?
Sorry. Yes, please.
That's okay. So on the issue of kindergarten students who are in special education, if the federal special education law requires services to that student that expand beyond a half day, I'm wondering what the reimbursement is to districts if they're required to provide services that go beyond a half day, if this formula accounts for those expenses that school districts are incurring on behalf of those students. And so that's the basis of the question. So when you're checking, I thought that might help with finding the answer. Thank you.
Is it possible that may come under an early childhood or special education program that would be funded differently?
I don't know.
I think because it's kindergarten, it would be the school district's responsibility to provide the educational services to that child, and they'd be out of the ECSE.
Probably right. Go ahead.
Okay. A little bit more information about the IEP extra weight. I did a report this last interim that looked at some data and tried to look at costs and weight revenue for these students. The IEP students make up a little over 13% of ADM. We have a requirement that only 11% of those ADM can be qualified for the IEP one extra weight unless they go through the waiver process. Only 25 districts are below the 11%, and 167 are above the 11%. So those 167 can ask for waivers. The waivers covered about 4,500 IEP students in 2004-05, the year that of the data that I was using. And with the waiver, about 89% of IEP students have a weight. So there's not too many that don't qualify either within the 11% or as a waiver. The last item here is looking at costs and revenue. About half of the districts report costs less than their weight-generated revenue. And that also included federal and ESD dollars for those students. The half that had revenue above their costs, that difference wasn't very much, very narrow for the most part. For the districts where the expenses were above the weighted revenue, there was a large gap. Okay. And that's, I think, to be expected. But if this weight comes up, we can look at that report and provide more information about the IEP weight and the results of that weight. Also looked at similar questions for the ESL weight, extra weight of 1/2. 124 districts report having students in ESL programs, and they make up about 11% of ADM. Here we find that the costs per ESL student are only about $1,500, and the weight generated about $2,600 in revenue for those students, ignoring federal funds even. So, I didn't get It's not ESD in the third, fourth bullet. It's ESL. You can get that corrected. So here is one situation where the weight revenue generally exceeds what the districts are currently reporting as cost for those language programs. Okay. And that just shows that there's no requirement, again, for those funds to be spent on the various programs that the weight is associated with. And 12 districts reported cost more than weight revenue. So they were kind of the exception to the rule. And again, there's another report with a lot of detail about that. This is just some of the general conclusions from that report. The next slide gives you an idea of the number of students with each of the weights. Poverty weight being the largest with about 80-some thousand students. Special education, about 70,000. English as a second language, a little over 50,000. And then the other two being relatively minor.
That sounded awesome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question going back to the last slide that you had. What I'm interested in is how long has that been going on for the 1,500 versus the 2,600?
Well, what those numbers are depends upon what year you're talking about. But I would expect that it's been going on a number of years. That weight has been there from the beginning of the formula.
Why don't we, I mean, I'm just curious, why don't we adjust that then and reflect what actual to actual is there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, you'll have the argument perhaps that the district, that the program isn't at the level that it should be, so that if they were providing more English language training, that the cost would be closer to the weight generated revenue. It's helped certain districts quite a bit.
When we provide funds under the formula to the district is not restricted on how they spend that money, as long as they spend it within the areas that are related to that the state provides the funds for in general.
The exception being transportation.
So presumably, and this is really the question, presumably the funds that the district is receiving that it's not spending on an ESL student, it's spending somewhere else in the instruction program, probably.
Probably.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelson.
Until recently, I served on a school board, and we frequently had people that were advocates for ESL students that were concerned that ESL dollars were not going to pay for that. The superintendent of that school district in this year implemented a plan where she's asking the schools to identify where they're spending that extra weight of dollar within those school programs to address those needs of students, and if not, where those other dollars are going. So it might be interesting to look at as a case study a district that's very intentionally looking at that question to see, is it that it doesn't cost as much to support those kids, or is it school districts prioritizing where to put their dollars and it's going to different places in an instructional program?
So perhaps those funds are going to support the same student, but in a different way? Is that the suggestion?
I think possibly one of the responses that we had gotten was, where do you count that cost for educating that student? Is it all in that cost of that ESL person, or is that student also benefiting when you're putting a teacher in that classroom and trying to keep your class sizes in the third grade from going to 33 to 35? So where is that instructional benefit? And then the question from the advocates for the students was, if the money is given to do this and we're underfunding these programs, why aren't we having any accountability for these dollars going to address the specific needs of these students? So that constant pull in underfunded schools between the need of the basic programs and also the needs of students that have unique needs.
You're describing the perennial problem of a school superintendent and of a school board trying to make ends meet.
Yes.
Thank you.
This chart just shows what the dollar amounts are associated with the weight. We have the one weight here being about $5,500, and then adding to that for the weight generated dollars. So for special education, the extra weight doubles the dollars associated with that student. There are some other weights that...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelson.
Just a quick question. How do you, what is the definition of a neglected student?
Can't answer that.
Okay.
That's a group weight, and that comes from human resources. So it's whatever definition they use.
So it's not, so it might be just a percentage of the student population, or might it be kids that are in foster care?
It would not be a percent of the population. It would be foster care and other students that are being identified.
Okay. Thank you.
There are some weights that are not student-related, so much as grade-related. We still have a Union High School district and a few elementary districts. They have their own weights, trying to reflect that it costs more, with the assumption being that it costs more to educate a high school student than it does an elementary student. If you combine all of the elementary students and with the Union High School students in terms of those weights, you would come up with a weight of one, as though it were a unified district. So it's just a way of splitting the dollars between those two kinds of districts. And then we have weights for small elementary schools and small high schools, which can vary by school size. This gives you an idea of the extra weight associated with a small high school. It would be the area between the horizontal or the diagonal line and the curved line, the extra weight, and the weight vertically above the number across the bottom for the number of students in that school, and would tell you where to be in that chart and how many extra students would be counted for that small high school. There's calculations in the statute that direct how that is determined, and a few sessions ago small high schools were arguing that funding wasn't enough, and so there was an adjustment. Prior to that, if a high school was too close to the next nearest high school, that extra weight was reduced based upon that difference in mileage. But that was done away with, and so it's not based upon distance anymore, just size. A list of qualifications, basically they're there to prevent any new small high schools. So if you have a charter school that's a small high school, it won't qualify. It hasn't been in existence long enough. And I'll skip over the rest of those. The small elementary school qualifications are similar to the high schools, just like the and the number of students varies by grade for qualification. It has to be more than 8 miles to the nearest elementary school, and the weight is reduced if it's between that 8 and 12 miles. Once you get to the 12 miles, you get the full amount of the extra weight.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. Is there a reason why the statute is 8 miles to the nearest elementary school without making a distinction that elementary school is within the same school district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, as far as I know, that's just historic.
That's just... Do you have any follow-up? I'm aware that there have been a couple of schools that have closed, small elementary schools, because they have been close to that 8 miles to a nearby school, but it's been outside of the school district. And so you would have students that would be tens of miles away from their local school, but that school is still not eligible for that small school qualification. What would the drawback be to making it 8 miles to the nearest elementary school within the same school district where the student would have access to transportation to get to school if they're tens of miles away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, that has been proposed in legislation. Hasn't passed yet. That's why.
All right.
Remember, we're in the committee where things don't have to make sense.
Okay.
They just are.
Just are.
We want them to make sense, but sometimes they don't.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to the next chart, then this compares ADM to ADMW Extended to give you an idea of the difference. Generally, ADMW Extended has been about 25% higher than ADM, so that if you want dollars per student to be higher, you use an ADM count and not an ADMW count. But the formula uses ADMW Extended, and so that's what you'll typically see on tables that I do that involve dollars per student.
And to remind me, that's the reference to the schools in a declining enrollment situation, where they get to count last year's numbers instead of this year's numbers.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to the teacher experience component of the general purpose grant. It's $25 times the difference between the district average teacher experience in years and the state average. This is there to give some incentive for districts to hire more experienced teachers. But it may have also been initially related to districts that were well off that had higher paid teachers to help them phase into the formula and provide some compensation for that in the formula. So $25 at the time was a one-step increase for one additional year of experience. It hasn't been changed since then, so it's no longer a one-step increase anymore. It's a fraction of that now. And it equals out over all of the districts. Some districts benefit from that $25 being above the average. Other districts have that $25 per year subtracted because they're below the state average. And so in balance, it pretty much equals out. Just shifts dollars around. Okay, so we have all of our factors for the general purpose grant except one now, the balance ratio. So we have ADMW extended times $2,500 increased either or decreased by that $25 per year difference from the state average, and then times the balance ratio. The balance ratio is there because we have to make state revenue and local revenue equal the sum of these four grants. Okay. The amount of dollars in transportation is unlimited. The high cost disability and the facility grant has caps. So the only grant then that changes is the general purpose grant, and what triggers that is the balance ratio. So if there's more funds available, it's going to go to the general purpose grant via the balance ratio increasing. Currently, that ratio is about 1.17, or an additional 17%. That's flexible depending upon the dollars available. So that's how we make the revenue available balance what the grants generate. The general purpose grant is the one that can go up or down based upon that balance ratio. All right. Now, what I have done here is just to substitute the detail for each of the grants in place of the name. And so here we want to just take a couple minutes to get a feel for what happens given a change. Play a little bit of a what-if game. We just talked about state revenue, what happens there. What happens if local revenue goes up in one district? Okay. Suppose there's a private utility constructed in that district that's taxable. Its local revenue increases dramatically. Does it keep all of that local revenue generated by that utility plant? Okay. What happens? Right? Our total statewide local revenue increases so that the state revenue plus local revenue has increased. Nothing else has really changed, or we're assuming it hasn't changed, other than there's more money, so that that balance ratio increases and the general purpose grant increases. What happens to that district, though, with the utility? It has more local revenue. The formula says every district statewide should get a little bit more money because there's more available. But the district that has a lot, all of that extra local revenue, gets less state revenue. That state revenue that it loses is spread among all of the other school districts in the state. So it's as if that local revenue doesn't totally benefit the district where it's located. That's an important concept to remember, because you'll hear conversations about it in the hallway. It doesn't do a district any good to have more revenue if it ends up being shared statewide by the formula. Okay, what happens if one district decides that it's going to build a high school that is the Taj Mahal of high schools? Does it affect all of the other school districts? Or does it just affect a few school districts or only that school district? It qualifies for additional construction costs, but there's a cap on that. If you're already at the cap, it doesn't give any more dollars to the facility grants. So it doesn't affect the districts that don't qualify for facility grants. It just redistributes the money among the districts that do qualify for the facility grants met by any, because of the cap. Okay. The high-cost disability would work the same way because of the cap. If transportation costs go up dramatically, there's no cap there. State and local revenue are the same. What gives is the balance ratio goes down. The general purpose grant decreases. The transportation grant has increased the same amount. The other two don't change. Right, so basically you can know how legislation that changes the formula affects your districts if you think through that process without seeing the numbers. But everybody still wants to see the numbers, and you'll have those. Any questions about that before moving on? Okay. How important are each of the grants? The general purpose grant makes up over 95% of the total. Transportation about 4%, facility grants 2/10, and high cost disability about 3/10. So you can see the magnitude of the general purpose grant of the total and the relative small size of the transportation component. You'll probably be looking at legislation that wants to change the transportation calculation. The question is how much efficiency can be drawn out of that 4%. And how important that is to the overall fairness of the formula. State payment schedule, you get 2 months worth of dollars in July, and then 1 month's worth in each of the following months, no payment in June. That's how the money goes out, or when it goes out. Here you have a little bit of a history in terms of the revenue. Note that the little white spaces at the top that are framed in is money that's going to the school districts outside the state school fund, but it hasn't been considered a part of school funding in those years. In 2001-02, you had the school improvement fund that had money, $108 million that year. But prior to that, you also had money going to districts outside the formula, backed by lottery bonds that went to the districts for specific, fairly general capital needs, books, computers, a whole list of things that qualify. So there's some histories preceding the school improvement fund for money being distributed to districts outside the formula. Okay, then again, some history on revenue per student. Again, going back to, if you want a high number, you use ADM. If you want a lower number, use ADM debit. And you can see how it varied from year to year over time, mostly up, but a few years where it declined year over year. All right. This chart is to try to give you an idea of the history of what's happened with the implementation of the school equalization formula. If you go back to 91-92 and look at the revenue differences per student and you rank those from highest to lowest, you see that it varies from about 3,000 to over 5,000. If you included all of the districts and not just those with students having more, or districts having more than 500 ADM, that line would go up to $7,000 or $8,000 per student in 91-92. By 03-04, with the implementation of the equalization formula, those differences per weighted student by district have dropped to the hundreds of dollars per weighted student difference, not thousands of dollars per student difference. That's been the equalization impact of the formula. Okay, I'm ready to...
Excuse me, just a moment before you go on. Did you say that you truncated the 91-92 group by omitting the very small schools?
Yes, I did.
Thank you. That's what I thought you said. Okay.
Basically, for the sake of getting
sure.
a smaller graph.
Right.
And there's very few that were at that,
well,
on, that high level as well.
Very, very small schools are relatively more costly, and that makes sense.
But there were some very small school districts that had high property wealth at that time, too.
Hmm. Yes.
Okay, education service districts. Just a little bit about those. I like to show a map to give you an idea of the ESD regions around the state. There's 20 of them. The ESDs follow school district boundaries, even though I show them by counties. The ESD that has the most counties are the Northwest with four counties. Most of the others, a few, I think three, have three-county territories, and the rest are one or two counties. For ESD equalization, they came after the school districts. We went through the equalization process for school districts, then the legislature tackled equalizing ESD revenue. So the formula was already in place before ESD equalization really took root. And so the general logic was that ESDs provide similar services to school districts. Their costs are related to the costs of their component school districts. The school districts are already getting dollars based upon the weights. So maybe the ESD should just use the school district formula dollars to determine how much they should have. And that's basically the decision, that the ESD revenue should be proportional to the formula revenue of its component school districts. So they didn't have to develop their own formula. The base revenue for an ESD then is about 5% of the component school district formula revenue. It's more than 4.75%, more than that 4.75% share of the total, because you're not taking it times the total, you're taking it times 95.25% of the total. So it's almost 5%. All right, that's the base revenue. And going back to Representative Butler's comments, the legislature thought that, well, for small ESDs, some of just using that percent didn't generate enough money to have a viable ESD operation. So they put a floor of $950,000 under those ESDs. That made the total available more than the state and local revenue for ESDs. So that, again, you have to multiply those by a percent slightly less than 100. That's 99.7 or close to that. So ESD revenue then has grown also over time, but a few years follows basically the same pattern. You can see the impact there on local revenue as Measure 5 was implemented, and then the slow growth under Measure 47 and 50. Any questions about ESD? Tried to make that relatively quick. All right, well, we have a few minutes. If you'll bear with me, we'll talk about local option.
Oh, the fun part.
The local option is the lesser of three amounts in terms of what gets excluded from school district formula local revenue. A school district can raise as much local option revenue as it wants within the gap that it has available. But if it raises over 15% of formula revenue, or $750 per student, whichever is the lower of the two, it can do that. But the amount that's over that $750 per student gets added back to the local revenue of the school district and basically does them no good, because that's going to get shared statewide. So there's no incentive to do it, but it's possible to do. And again, that $750 now is smaller than the 15% for those two. But still, the gap controls what districts can raise in most districts. Just an example, showing you the relative size. In this case, it would be the gap that controls. A table of local option elections. Just to show the history and to show that local option elections haven't been all that successful since they started in 1999.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Do you have any idea how many of those in the fail category passed on the majority that failed due to the double majority requirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I have that information. I don't have it with me.
All right. Thank you. I know that that's happened a couple of times, and I think one of the interesting things about double majorities as well, it would be interesting to compare to county levies as well, because we end up with local governments essentially having to compete with each other because they've quickly learned that they need to stack all of their money measures on a single ballot, which could also make it very difficult for a school local option levy to be in that pass column.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, if I remember correctly, it's not getting the 50% majority was more frequent than not getting the voter turnout, not meeting the voter turnout requirements on the fails.
Okay. Thank you.
But I have that for you. Okay, there is a local option equalization process. I don't really want to go through it at this stage unless you want me to. It involves about $200,000 a year. And the intent is to make it possible for districts to have equal dollars for equal tax effort. So if two districts have the same local option tax rate, that they would tend to generate the same dollars per student from that rate as the district that is at that 75th percentile of assessed value per student.
Where do the dollars come from to pay that?
Typically, they have come from the general fund. This session, those extra dollars were overlooked, and so for the time being, they're designated out of the state school fund. Whether it stays that way or not, I don't know. So it could be one of those items that comes off the state at the top of the state school fund before splitting it between school districts and the ESDs.
So this is based on a statutory requirement that this be done.
Yes.
Thank you.
But it wouldn't have to be funded. Okay. And there are provisions is that if the appropriation isn't high enough, then it's prorated. All right. Education Stability Fund. I'm not really going to say anything about this because you've covered some of it already, and we'll see a lot more of it. They're there just for your reference purposes. And then after that, you have some slides on the governor's school budget. Again, they're there for your reference, not to go through it. If you want to, if you're an accountant and want to see more of the detail, but the accountant isn't here right now, so it basically it shows you how much of the local revenue and the $6 billion in proposed state school fund goes to school districts, how much the ESDs by year, et cetera. So there for your information. The last slide gives a potential formula issues. In the past, they have centered mostly around how to treat declining districts and growth districts in the formula. There hasn't been really much issue in terms of student weights or transportation, and except for the change in the percentages. There's been issues about small schools. There's been issues about what should be included in local revenue and what shouldn't be. And then teacher experience hasn't been really an issue lately, if ever, since the formula started. But there's legislation this time, so it's up for review.
Questions? I have a couple. Just to make sure that we're understanding, Representative Olson raised an issue around the English as a second language students and the weighting that we use for that. If I understand this correctly, because we're dealing with a pot of money in any given biennium, and a total amount, if we were to change the student weighting, the effect of that would be to lower the ADMW or raise it if we were to increase the weights,
yes,
and that would result in a different division of that pot of money. The size of the pot doesn't change, but perhaps the distribution among school districts might.
Mr. Chair, the general purpose grant amounts would change per weighted student.
Correct, because the number of weighted students changed.
Correct.
But I guess the point I'm making, and I want to see if you agree with this, is that as we change that number of weighted students, the amount per student varies inversely in a way that would not affect the overall dollars available, but might affect the distribution of those dollars to the school districts.
Yes, it would.
Okay. The other area that I wanted to talk about was back on your slides. And probably you're numbering them, if I've understood the numbering system correctly, 48 and 49. And I guess I wanted to use these are the two slides about the history of the K-12 formula revenue from 90 to 2006. 2007, and to note that as Measure 5 kicked in, if you look at the lighter shaded area on our graphs, yes. As Measure 5 kicked in, the number of dollars that coming from local sources declined significantly. While the number of dollars from the state increased very significantly, but for several years had very little effect on the overall dollars available under the formula. You look at from 92 through about 97 or so, it actually fell in 93-94 and only increased very, very slightly after that until we get to 97-98, if I read the graph correctly.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And so one could say that at that time the dollars from the state was increasing at a very high rate, maybe even an alarming rate, if you considered simply state funds being put into this enterprise. But that the effect it actually had on schools was extremely low because of the decline in the local funds available.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Before Measure 5, the estate dollars were about 30% of the total and local dollars 70%. After Measure 5 was phased in, that was just reversed, 70% state and 30% local.
So it might be true to say, and I'm making up some numbers here, that, that there was a huge increase in the percentage of dollars coming from the state, but that didn't have an effect on the overall amount of funds available because of the decline, the comparable decline in the local situation. Now, the other change, as I recall, that was being happening at around the same time, and you know the year and I don't, it was equalization. So that some school districts actually had a significant improvement in their dollars per student during that period of time, while other school districts had a significant decline in their dollars per student because of equalization. Would that be a fair characterization? This graph doesn't illustrate that, but...
The other graph did, that had the comparison over time.
Yes.
All right. That shows you the effect of the formula on basically raising up the low-funded districts.
Yes.
Right? And bringing down the high-funded districts on a per-student basis.
Thank you. Yes, that was exactly right. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to add kind of a minor note, but historically during that period, you see things bouncing around a bit because one of the things we had a hard time doing was projecting local revenue under Measure 5.
Yes.
Because the assessed values were growing faster than we anticipated, so you had the legislature kind of correcting that at various times, and that's caused some of that volatility in there when local revenue would be above or below expectations.
Right. I specifically remember, and the reason I raise this is that what got me involved in politics in an active way, other than just as a voter, in the first place, was the decision by the Eugene School Board to lay off 100 teachers in that period when there was a decline in the funds available that this slide shows in 93-94. That's what got me involved in this process and what ultimately ended up with me being in the legislature. And so that little blip there is very important to me as an individual as I think about why I got involved in this thing in the first place. I suspect some of the other people in the room have had similar experiences. And so these numbers, while they on a graph like that don't look very big. In fact, they had huge effects around the state. Thank you. Anything else? Anything else for today? If not, we are adjourned.
I know.